Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. We are always happy to have him. He joins us weekly. The films are Double Lover and the 1517 to Paris. And hi, David, how are you? I really do want to know what you thought of that film.
Which one?
Second one? Yep. So you're going to make me wait.
Okay.
I know.
Precisely because it's the second one, you are going to have to wait for just a tiny little while. Because I want to start off by talking about Double Lover, or L'Amant Double, as the French title has it. And this is a movie by François Ozon, who is a pretty good filmmaker. And he's made quite a long number of films, a French filmmaker. And he's made different kinds of movies. He's made sort of comedies and sort of thrillers and sort of dramas. And this is one that sort of is certainly not a comedy. It's sort of somewhere in between the melodrama and the thriller. And Double Lover, the title turns out to be extremely appropriate. Double Lover, the main character is a young woman named Chloe. She is in her middle 20s, and she has been having pains in her stomach, which could result from some organic ailment. And at the beginning of the film, she is in fact being examined by a gynecologist who says, no, there's nothing organically wrong with you. So maybe it's something else. And so Chloe gets a referral to see a psychiatrist on the theory that this might be possibly caused by psychological stresses or some such things. And so she starts talking with her new psychotherapist, whose name is Paul Meyer. And they seem to connect very nicely, and he says nothing for many sessions, which is, of course, the norm in certain kinds of psychotherapy. And then eventually he says something at just the right moment, which touches off a clue based on something she just said. And she really feels that she is getting very much better. And he says, well, now we must end our sessions. And she says, why? And he says, because I have developed strong feelings for you. So you know how these things go, especially in the movies, I suppose. Instead of ending the sessions, they're just struck. And every relationship, they become lovers. And the next thing you know, she is moving in with him, and all seems well. He is a handsome young man. She is a beautiful young woman. She herself doesn't seem to have any strong intellectual pursuits. She was working as a model. Now she gets a job as a security guard in a museum. But they seem to just get along just splendidly, and everything in their life is fine. Only, it turns out that apparently he has been keeping a secret from her. Apparently he has a brother. And when she starts to discover this, he won't reveal anything about it. When she asks direct questions, he gives a sort of an answer that clears things up a little bit, but not very much. And in fact, this brother is not only a brother, but he is a twin brother. So this is a twin movie. And as you know, Jill, this is the kind of movie that interests me a lot because my own sons are identical twins. And so it turns out that Paul Meyer, and Meyer was not his original name, his original name was Paul Delord, has an identical twin brother named Louis Delord, who is also a psychotherapist. And in order to start to clear up a little bit of the mystery and maybe start trying to figure out why her husband is not, well, he's not her husband, actually, they're still just living together, but why he has never said anything and is reluctant to say a single word about this twin brother, okay, maybe they don't get along, but why the total secrecy? She strikes up, makes an appointment with the second psychiatrist, the second guy who is the twin who she's never met before, under an assumed name, and she starts seeing him. And he turns out to be very different from the good psychiatrist who we've gotten to know, that lovely lover of Chloe. He turns out to be aggressive, and he said, this is just my treatment technique. I do it very different from my brother. But the next thing you know, they're having sex, and they're having violent sex, and it gets worse and worse. So I thought that the whole maybe first 20 minutes of Double Lover were really interesting, very atmospheric, very mysterious. In fact, it may have gone on for as long as half an hour that I was really enjoying this film. What is going to turn out here? But once we start to get into really getting to know that second mysterious twin brother a little bit, I realized, this is the kind of French movie that we have seen before. Well, of course, we've seen all kinds of movies before, practically, but this is the kind we've seen a really lot before. This is a story of l'amour fou. This is a story of mad love. This is a story of insane passion. Okay, that's fine. Some of those movies are really good. But as this went along, it just, to me, got sillier and more trite. It started to devolve into long sex scenes. I know, everybody loves long sex scenes, but when there are too many of them and when they're too long, they do get kind of boring. And the action, again, gets more and more melodramatic and less like what I regard as a real thriller, which is supposed to sort of get under your skin a bit. And there are some pretty effective moments along the way. We meet a woman who the twins were involved with long ago, and she turns out to be sort of a really shocking part of the film that comes up quite late and doesn't go on, unfortunately, for very long, because I found it very effective. And eventually, I was just sort of waiting for the movie to be over, which eventually it is. And it leaves a lot of mystery and sort of murkiness at the end, which you can see is sort of resonant and daring, or you can see is just, oh, by this time, who really cares anyway? So, very well acted movie. Maureen Vacth is very, very fine as Chloe, our main character. Jeremy Renier is good as both of the twins. It was delightful to see Jacqueline Bisset, good old Jackie Bisset, back playing two roles. And by the way, there are some characters in this film who do play two roles who are not twins, which is another one of the movie's sort of efforts to kind of mystify us. There's also some sort of a record-breaking number of shots in this movie that involve mirrors. So the idea of the double lover is carried forth in all kinds of different ways. Very stylish movie. Very handsome movie, a lot of lovely people to look at, a few people who aren't so lovely to look at. If you really enjoy the French film of L'amour fou, this movie will please you, just tickle you pink. If you've seen this sort of thing too many times before, it will leave you, as it left me, kind of, okay, so what else is new? What's next? So now I will tell what's next for us, the movie you've been dying to hear about, Jill, the 1517 to Paris. And this is the new movie by Clint Eastwood. I will take this opportunity to plug once again. Actually, I've hardly ever done it. My fairly recent book on Clint Eastwood.
Plug away.
That came out something like 3 or 4 years ago, called The Cinema of Clint Eastwood: Chronicles of America. Even though this movie takes place in Paris, it fits in with Clint's general overall trajectory. I'll also plug a new book that's not quite out yet, a movie called Tough Ain't Enough, New Perspectives on the Films of Clint Eastwood, edited by David Desser and my friend Lester D. Friedman. And I have an essay in that about Clint's biopics. And I suppose if I were writing that essay now, I might include the 1517 to Paris in it, because it is, in fact, a biopic of sorts. Not a very powerful biopic, but it does kind of tell the story of these young men's lives. So the 1517 to Paris is about an incident, and it's based on real events. It's about an incident that took place, going on 3 years ago. It was in the sort of the late summer of 2015. And everybody heard about that because on a train that was bound for Paris going through France, there was an attempted terrorist attack by a guy with a gun, a very vicious guy who obviously wanted to wipe out a whole lot of people. And three young Americans who were on that train immediately went into action, and they subdued the guy, and there was an injury or two, but they really obviously prevented a major tragedy from taking place, which is very much to their credit, that's for sure. So that is what this movie is about. The thing about 1517 to Paris, and by the way, of course, that is just European time. It's the 317 train to Paris in the afternoon. The trouble with this movie, the trouble that was sort of built into this movie to begin with, is the fact that this whole incident, judging by the movie itself, was probably over in about 5 minutes. Probably a lot less than that, actually. I mean, that's true. There was a badly injured person, and they had to get that person to safety, although that is only hardly even figures in the film. But if you don't count that part of it, the actual incident, the eruption of the violence, the subduing of the guy, the saving of all the passengers on the train, took really very, very little time, a matter of minutes, and not very many minutes at that. So here we have a movie that's got to be a feature film. And in fact, it lasts a bit over an hour and a half. So how are you going to do this? So the way you do this is by getting into all kinds of things that have virtually nothing to do with the event that the movie is named after and the event that the whole movie was made because of. So what we do is almost immediately we start flashing back to our three main characters, and by their names are Alec, Anthony, and Spencer. We flash back to them as children. And we see that they had some troubles in elementary school, or maybe it's middle school, and their moms got caught in for teacher conferences and things like that. And so we have some scenes there. By the way, what a delight to see playing one of the moms, Jenna Fischer, who I really like from The Office, the TV series. Anyway, it's good to see her, although it's a very small role. So, okay, we have these three kids, and yes, they are cut-ups. And yes, they get into trouble at school and they don't pay attention and this kind of thing. Okie doke. Then they're a little bit older and they're doing things that kids do when they're a little bit older. And then they're young adults. And what are they going to do? And one of them gets a job at a coffee joint. And another one does this. And another one does that. The main character is really the one who gets that job at the coffee joint. And what he decides to do, the three guys are all main characters of the film, but definitely one of them is more equal than the others. He decides he's always kind of wanted to go into the service, and he's always really kind of liked guns, and he's always really kind of liked the idea of saving other people. Also, there's a religious dimension to this movie, and two of them actually were in Catholic school as children, and one of them clearly maintains his very religious sort of attitudes well into life. And one of the reasons why he wants to go into the armed services is because he sort of believes God maybe has something in store for him. And that's a little theme that comes up again and again in the movie. So we have them as young adults. Then we follow mainly the guy who goes into the service. Occasionally we visit with the other two guys, and we see the paths that their lives are taking. And then eventually they meet up again as young men. And they decide they're all going to go on a trip together to Europe. And they're going to sort of bum around Europe. Well, they don't exactly bum around. This is the climactic scene in the movie. They're in the first class compartment of the train when it breaks out. But they're going to go around Europe. And now we have a whole part. I told you this movie is, a large part of this movie is about killing time up until we get to the incident that it's named after. And every once in a while, we have a flash forward to the incident itself, I guess to keep us awake in our seats while we're watching all of this. But then we come back to the long scenes of the kids in middle school and the long scenes of the kids as young adults trying to decide what they're going to do with their lives. Then we get to the scene of the trip to Europe, when we have long scenes, the three guys sort of wandering around Europe. And this is a travelogue. We have scenes of the guys in Venice. We have scenes of the guys in Rome. We have scenes of the guys in Amsterdam. Oh, look, there's the Colosseum. Wow, it's really big. Yeah, but just think about it. People were actually killed there. I mean, it's a travelogue, and it's not a very good travelogue. And then finally, we get up to the incident that the movie is named after, which is very effectively done. Clint Eastwood, of all directors, knows how to do violence and combat and fighting and stuff like that. So it's very effective. But even though it takes longer in the movie than it probably took in real life, it's just really not a very big part of this film. And then it's over. And then we have a long speech by the president of France expressing thanks to the two boys. So what I'm trying to get across here, Joe, is that this movie is not very interesting. Very little of it has to do with the incident the film is named after. And that's fine. But the build-up to it and the coming down off it at the very end are just not inventive and not interesting. The movie was scripted by Dorothy Bliskow, and the script is based on a book that was written by the three actual men themselves, along with another person who obviously was the one who really wrote the book, based on what they told him. And so it's all, I suppose, authentic enough. And maybe that authenticity is what prevented them from putting very much that was interesting into the movie. But it's not an interesting movie. Now, I haven't mentioned what is arguably the most important thing about the movie, which is that Clint decided to have the three young men who actually performed this heroic action back in 2015 play themselves. And they are not very good actors. And even playing themselves, doing things they did, they are just not very convincing. They are all too obviously saying, all three of them this goes for, saying things the way they were told to say them, pausing when they were told to pause, giving a little smile when they were told to give a little smile, and that sort of thing. It's very hard to direct people who don't have any acting training at all. It can be done, and it's been done triumphantly in many cases in film history, but it's not an easy thing to do, and Clint Eastwood, alas, does not pull it off here. Clint Eastwood is a fascinating director. He's directed good movies, and he's directed bad movies. In recent years, I think he's been going in the direction that the 1517 to Paris is going in. It's a movie which is obviously meant to appeal to values of patriotism, to values of loving your country, of wanting to serve your country, of putting your life on the line for your country. He did this recently in his movie American Sniper, which I did not like much at all, but at least that movie was pretty well made. The 1517 to Paris is one of the most carelessly and dully made movies of Clint Eastwood's long and storied career, and I think everybody will do themselves and him a service by staying away. So take the 1517 to Paris in the opposite direction from Paris or from your local movie theater. And that is my disappointed story this week, Joe.